You are listening to Help for HD Live, the first podcast created for families living with Huntington's and juvenile Huntington's disease. Don't forget to find us on iTunes, Blog Talk, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. You can also search over 500 archived episodes and other projects at helpforhd.org. To watch us in person, find Help for HD TV on YouTube and subscribe and ring the bell for notifications on new content. Help for HD Live is going on air in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in to Help for HD Live. This program is made possible because of Teva Pharmaceuticals, Neurocrine Biosciences, and the Griffin Foundation. I'm your host, Lauren Holder, and today we are on with Pierre Rodriguez Aliaga from Stanford University. He is a Hereditary Disease Foundation grant winner. And we are going to be talking about his research today, which is how disease-causing mutations in the Huntington protein render it toxic. So I'm just going to read this little blurb from the Hereditary Disease Foundation for you guys so you have an idea of what he is working on. The risk of developing HD is tightly linked with the length of a specific region within the Huntington protein. Genetic mutations can make this region longer than normal, rendering the protein toxic to neurons. The mechanism behind this length-dependent toxicity remains unknown, mainly because the Huntington protein's highly disordered and aggregation-prone nature prevents most current experimental methods from obtaining high-resolution images of its structures. To circumvent these technical barriers, Dr. Rodriguez Aliaga is using a Nobel Prize-winning technology to study one Huntington molecule at a time, a method which allows access to structural information about pathogenic and non-pathogenic Huntington variants with unprecedented detail. Don't worry, guys. This is where we're going to talk about this and go into what all of this means, but I wanted to make sure that you had an idea of what we were doing. So using this approach, he has found previously unreported structural differences between the pathogenic and non-pathogenic Huntington variants, differences which may explain how disease-causing Huntington mutations lead to HD. He's currently studying how Huntington's structure is affected by chemical modifications commonly found in brains of HD patients and other proteins and drugs known to bind Huntington and inhibit or to decrease its toxicity. So thank you so much for coming on today, Pierre, and talking with us about your research.
Thank you, Lauren, for the invitation. A pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So let's get into your research and basically what I read and what it means and what you're doing with it.
Okay. So as you mentioned briefly in the introduction, I work with the Huntington protein. The Huntington protein is actually the protein responsible for the onset of Huntington's disease. So there are some mutations in this protein. Specifically, there's part of the protein that gets lengthened. So specifically, there's one specific amino acid called glutamine that in normal conditions, it has 35 repeats. That's in normal conditions. Your brain, my brain has 35 glutamines, okay? But in Huntington's disease, this repeat goes beyond 35 glutamines. So a very big question in the field is what happens to the protein when this threshold of 35 glutamine goes beyond this 35 glutamine? What happens to the protein? What makes it toxic? So there has been a lot of speculation. There is a lot of hypotheses around it, but there has not been direct proof, experimental evidence to show what happens when the protein goes beyond that threshold, which is what happens in patients with Huntington's disease. So when I joined the lab in Stanford in 2017, I was coming from a totally different field. I also work in proteins, but in a different approach. So I work in the laboratory of Judith Friedman, in which they have worked with Huntington's disease for many, many years. So there was a group meeting, so someone from my lab was presenting the results on Huntington. And in during the introduction, they mentioned what I just told you about the problem with this threshold of 35 glutamines. And I made a very naive question in the group meeting, and I said, what happens to the protein when when Huntington goes beyond 35 glutamines? And the question, the answer was that there was no answer. Like it was not, it was no evident to know that. And it's not because, and I later talked to Judith more about this because this really caught my attention. And Judith, which is my postdoc supervisor, she told me that, well, basically it's not because the scientists are lazy or they don't find this interesting, that there's no answer for this. It's because working this protein with the Huntington protein is very, very difficult. So if you want to understand what happens at the molecular level with these mutations, you need to obtain high resolution structures. And the problem with this protein is that as soon as you start making experiments, even with tiny amounts, it starts to aggregate. And that is a major technical barrier to obtaining high resolution images of the structure of the Huntington protein. And a second technical barrier to study this protein is that it is something that we call an intrinsically disordered protein. So it has many, many different conformations. So traditional structural methods use the average of millions of molecules to give you an answer. So if you study the Huntington protein that has many, many different conformations, you will obtain an average of those conformations using traditional structural methods. And if you use that average, you will obtain very poor resolution structures, which altogether explain why there has not been an answer to this problem. So, based on those conversations and that initial group meeting, I asked my supervisor to Judith, and I said, maybe we can study this protein with a very different approach. And this approach is a new technology in which I was trained during my PhD in Berkeley. I did a PhD in biophysics. So basically, biophysics is the study of biological systems using physical tools, lasers, using concepts from physics. So in Berkeley, I use a technology called optical tweezers, in which we study, which this technology was awarded a Nobel Prize in physics in 2018. So using this technology, I study many different molecular machines, many other proteins. So with that knowledge, with that training that I got from Berkeley, I suggested that we could study Huntington, but using a different approach. And the innovation of this approach is that we study one molecule at a time. As I said earlier, traditional methods analyze millions of molecules at the same time, and they take an average. But with this approach, which is something called single molecule technology, as the name indicates, we study one protein, one molecule at a time. So the average problem, we can get rid of that with this approach. And also, since we use very almost infinitesimal and small amounts of protein, it doesn't aggregate. So this is how this project started, as basically as a curiosity from a question that we had in a meeting with my supervisor. And she was very kind enough to give me the freedom to test this. She told me, okay, let's try it. So I started making all the protocols, preparing all the material to do these experiments. And well, after a few months of preparation, we did the very first experiment. It was a Saturday on 2019. And at the very first attempt, we obtained information. It worked, the very first attempt. It was so exciting that I called Judith about it, and she was so excited about it. It was a really nice day. And since then, this is how we started this project. Yeah.
So yeah, that's amazing. So, and you were using a technology that you had used previously. You said optical tweezers. Is that what
Yes.
you called it? So what is it? What is that?
Optical tweezers is actually a very simple concept, but also very powerful. It's a technology that it seems like you see in movies in Star Trek or Star Wars or Ghostbusters, that you use light to manipulate small particles or matter or object. So basically, we take that technology from movies and we take it to the real life, to the scientific world. And you can use small lasers. Actually, these are highly focused laser beams that we use to manipulate a micron size particles, like very, very tiny size particles. So by using this approach, you can attach some proteins, you can do some chemistry over the surface of these particles. So we could use plastic beads. So we use the lasers to trap small plastic beads. These are very, very tiny beads. And you can do some chemistry on the surface of these plastic beads in such a way that you can form a tether between these two plastic beads. So you capture two plastic beads and you can form a tether between them using a DNA molecule. And in the middle of that DNA molecule, of that tether, you can introduce the protein that you want to study. In this case, we introduce one single huntingtin protein. And you can move the laser. So you already have a tether, right? It's like a tug of war game. And instead of the person pulling from the rope, we use the laser, and you move the laser at will. And when you move away the laser from its original position, the tension inside the tether increases high enough that it will break the protein. So by breaking the protein, you can understand the structure and the conformation of that protein. And then if you move the laser to its initial position, then the tension in the tether relaxes, again, like a tug of war game. And when the force or the tension in that tether is relaxed, then the protein, in this case, huntingtin protein, it will refold back because there is no force trying to break it. So, and we can pull from it again multiple times and obtain information about the structure of the protein.
That's amazing. I say this every time somebody comes on who's a researcher, but the where we've gotten with technology is just mind-blowing. To
I
know
think this
that
is.
this is we're using technologies like this to be able to study Huntington's is I just don't have words. That's amazing.
Yes, yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think this is a nice example of how interdisciplinary science really it helps the advancement in science. Because this optical tweezer was an initial development in physics. They use this principle to trap atoms. Like purely if it's nothing biological, like I'm talking about atoms, molecules. And after many, many years, some biologists or biophysicists, they thought they could use this physics technology to study biological systems. And this is how we started working with this system. Yes.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And again, but the key word here is interdisciplinarity, because you know there's physics, there's chemistry, there's biology, there's cell biology, we're clinicians, all that stuff is that's I think that's key.
Yeah. So when you did this to the Huntington molecule, what did you find?
Okay, so th that's a good question. So this was what I just mentioned was like the initial experiments, of course. But the question that we wanted to, or the first question and the main question we wanted to answer was, is there any difference between the pathogenic huntingtin and the non-pathogenic huntingtin? So the huntingtin that is, let's say, in normal brains compared to the huntingtin protein that has been mutated and that is in patients with Huntington's disease. So in order to do that, we have two different proteins. One that had 12 glutamines, so is below the 35 glutamine threshold that I said. So that's a non-pathogenic version of that protein. And we made another pathogenic version that had 44 glutamines. So it was above the 35 glutamine threshold. And we use the optical tweezers to study them. We pull from them to see. We pull them and then relax. We use the optical tweezers. Actually, the scientific term is we unfolded the protein with force. And by doing that, we compare what we found. We compare the patterns of unfolding these proteins. And we observe differences between the pathogenic and a non-pathogenic Huntington. So those differences we can reconcile in this, we can basically make a model of how the conformation of the protein is based on these unfolding events. And we observe differences, and we make a model that indicate that actually the pathogenic Huntington it has a different, total different conformation than a non-pathogenic one. So why is that important? So first, it answers a long-standing question, which is how we started this conversation, that it's not known first what happens to the protein when it goes beyond the 35 glutamine. So now we're providing pioneering evidence about it, that there is indeed a difference. And second, we based on these observations, based on these differences, now we try to understand why this Huntington becomes toxic based on its structure. We can make predictions, we can make models, and actually we have a working hypothesis based on this confirmation that we're currently working on to validate if it's true or not. But the observations is already there. If you ask me about the significance of these results, so what matters? What's important? Okay, you saw differences, so what? So what the difference indicates that the conformation of the pathogenic huntingtin is such that it allows to interact with other huntingtin proteins, which it explains why it aggregates, why it becomes toxic to the cells. In contrast, the conformation of the huntingtin that is non-pathogenic is in such a way that it limits its interaction with other huntingtin proteins. And that explains why the huntingtin that we have in our brains, which is below 35 glutamines, doesn't aggregate or aggregates in a very minimal amount.
Wow. So we've confirmed that there is a difference in the Huntington protein in somebody with Huntington's disease versus somebody with a normal brain and normal Huntington levels by this process, which is amazing because we did not know this before.
Yes.
It was just a theory and now it's been confirmed. And now what you're working on is why
Yeah,
does
what are
it
the
become,
implications? Yeah.
what are the implications, and so can you tell me a little bit about that, what you're working on?
Yes. So all these experiments that we did with the optical tweezers are called in vitro. So they are made with isolated proteins. They are made basically in a glass tube, in a glass chamber. So it's an artificial scenario. So it's not, doesn't mimic exact. Of course, we try to mimic as possible the conditions in our cells, but this is not our cells, of course. So we have taken this model and these mutants that we have found and developed. And now what we ask, okay, but what are the implications in actual aggregation in our cells? And what are the implications of these mutants and these differences in real human cells, in the toxicity of human cells? So we took some of these mutants, some of the mutations that we identified that actually, so in addition to what I just said, we identified some specific parts of the protein in which you can tweak it, you can mutate that part, and it will change the conformation of the protein at will. So you can transform a pathogenic huntingtin into a non-pathogenic huntingtin and vice versa. So you can transform a non-pathogenic into a pathogenic one by doing some specific mutations, some tweaking in the parts of this protein. So those mutations help to further understand the mechanism behind this molecular switch that dictates the pathogenicity of the protein. So we identified these mutants and took some of these mutants to study how it aggregates. We started first in vitro in reaction tubes in the lab, but then we moved to study this in human cells, something we call HEK cells, and we observed that aggregation was consistent with our prediction. So the pathogenic conformations aggregated more, the non-pathogenic conformations aggregated less. And right now, we are making a collaboration. We just started a collaboration to study the toxicity of these mutants, these new mutants, in humans' neurons, which is where the real action takes place. We are very excited about those experiments that are about to start. So that way, we're going to connect, we're going to have a very comprehensive picture of what happens to the Huntington protein from its monomeric version, which is alone when it mutates by itself, then when aggregates, and then what happens in neurons in humans. So we will have the full picture of the history of the pathogenicity of this version of pathogenic and non-pathogenic Huntington proteins.
That's amazing. Well, congrats in getting to study in human neurons. Like, that's really exciting. I want to go back. You had mentioned that you can tweak it a little bit to make it go from pathogenic to non-pathogenic. Is that just like with the optical tweezers, you're able to do that, or is it something else where you were just kind of playing around and figured it out, or how did that come about?
That's a nice question. So basically, what we do is we change the sequence of amino acids of the protein. So instead of having the letter A, we mutate that specific letter A into another letter which has different properties. And that affects the conformation of the protein in such a way that it changes its entire conformation and it changes its pathogenic properties. So we basically make mutations on the protein and specific amino acids, and that's how it works.
That is, I just am just shocked because that's so amazing that you can do that.
Well, it's mutagenesis. It's something that is very simple to do in any molecular biology lab. They do these mutations to proteins. So
Is
we
it
do.
realistic to look at that as a potential treatment for HD in the future? Being able to do that, you think, or
Well,
is it just good information to know?
this is, I would say, central information to know, because you understand how it's happening. You're understanding the mechanism why the protein is becoming toxic. This is basic science that is very important for the development of drugs and in the identification of therapeutic targets. For example, if we prove that the conformation, but we prove and dissect and characterize very well the pathogenic conformation of Huntington, we can develop antibodies or some other strategies to neutralize those toxic conformation at very early stages. So if you do that, you in principle would inhibit aggregation and you would inhibit toxicity. So this opens a totally new approach to that wasn't known before to study or to fight or find a cure or probable therapies for Huntington's disease. And the reason this is, I want to emphasize, this is basic science, is important to understand the biological world. And I'm going to give you a very simple example. If you have a car and it fails, so your mechanic is going to have to repair it. But for the mechanic to repair the engine of your car, it needs to understand how it works, right? So here we're trying to understand how the Huntington protein becomes toxic. And I think that's key information for this field.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that I think it's amazing, right? Like you said, we have to know how it works, why it does what it does, in order to move forward with, potential treatments and all of that. But I find it all very interesting, especially because this is, like you said, it's kind of pioneering information. With newer technology that we've not seen before, and it's moving so much faster with the with this type of technology, and I just love it. I love that we're seeing things like the optical tweezers, which is not even part of this field, coming in to help with something like this. And that's incredible. So yeah, thank you for what you are doing.
Nothing. And the interesting part also of this system of the optical tweezers is that it can allow to study other similar proteins like huntingtin, like alpha-synuclein or tau. So these are two proteins that are equally responsible as huntingtin, but for the development of other diseases like Alzheimer or Parkinson's disease. They aggregate, they are difficult to work with, but again, structural information is poorly known about this protein. So in the future, that's something also I plan to expand this experimental system that I have developed to study all these similar proteins that are also involved in other neurodegenerative diseases.
That's amazing. That's incredible. And again, thank you. Thank you so much for doing this work, for asking the initial question and having the curiosity to find the answer. And look where you have come with that drive.
Perhaps some people in the audience may be wondering, okay, this sounds good. Where can I read it? I would like to read it. So this is not published yet. We're actually in the last stages of preparing this. And it has taken too long because initially our research or the goal was basically to make that characterization with the optical tweezers, and that's it, which we already did a couple of years ago. But because of that, every time I presented these results, people ask me, okay, what happens with these mutations in aggregation? Does it aggregate more, less? Okay, so I had to do those additional experiments. And when I did those aggregation experiments, I presented again this data to the audience or other researchers, and they told me, oh, this is really cool. But now what happens in real neuron cells? Okay, now, which is now why we're doing these experiments in neuron cells. And all this together has taken longer than we expected. So, anyways, it's not published yet, but it's going to be published soon.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, I can't wait to see the publication, and the stuff that you find along the way as you continue to explore and go into human neurons. And I'm sure it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, I'm very excited. There's a lot of very interesting research about Huntington in proteins in general, as well with other approaches. So I think the key is that there are different scientists with different expertise that are looking at this problem from very different perspectives. So that increases the chances or the probability that some of those new avenues will work at the end, right? Would produce some form of therapies or even a cure in the future.
Absolutely. And a huge thanks to Hereditary Disease Foundation for the work that they are doing in funding this research. Not only Pierre's, but other research programs and projects that are going on. So I just can't say enough great things about the Hereditary Disease Foundation and all they are doing to move things forward in HD and find those therapies, but also going back to the basic science and finding the answers to the questions that we haven't had answered. So, thank you so much, Pierre, for coming on and talking with us today. Very exciting stuff. And again, I look forward to hearing what you find as you continue your research.
Thank you, Lauren, for the invitation again. And I enjoyed sharing this with your audience, with HD patients, HD researchers, in general. Thank you.
Thank you. For those listening, please make sure that you are tuning in every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for a new show. If you're interested in coming on for our HD Uncut series, that is strictly for the HD community to come on and share their stories or whatever they want. It is your chance to have a voice. So please let me know if you are interested in coming on. If you are a researcher who would like to come on and share your research in HD, please reach out as well. My email is lauren@help4hd.org. That's LAUREN at HELP, the number 4 HD.org. And we can add you to our Young Investigator series. If you have a resource you would like to share with the HD community, that's one of the things right now Help for HD is really focusing on, is we've got this database we've created with resources, but I also love to have people on the podcast to share resources that are available to our community, whether it's strictly HD related or not. So please reach out. And until next time, guys, take care and love ya.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit www.helpforhd.org and sign up for our email newsletter to stay up to date on all that is going on at Help for HD. Get social with us and like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and subscribe to Help for HD TV on YouTube, and ring the bell for notifications.